There's a park in Compton called Athens Park. It has some grassy fields, a couple of baseball diamonds, and play structures. There's nothing extraordinary about it. No plaque or monument commemorating its role in history. But there should be. Because it was in this park, back in the mid-1960s, that a group of black men started meeting regularly. And together, hatched their ambitious plan.
We would go out in at night. We would, after people got off, because they had regular jobs. And we would meet out there at the park in the evening and get dark. We'd doing jumping jacks, and we, with the help of a few people, learning how to throw punches, how to fall off of the top, when he say off the top of the back of bleachers, onto mattresses. We didn't have very much to work with because we didn't know what we were doing.
That's Alex Brown, one of the men who trained in the park. There wasn't long before people in the neighborhood started to wonder exactly what kind of fight he and his friends were training for.
At that time, you know, there was a lot of racial tension at that time. We actually had the police come by and set up outside of our area and chain them. We would begin to, you know, watch us.
To the police, it looked like Black Panthers or some other local chapter of a militant group training for some kind of race war.
Every Saturday morning, we were there. The law enforcement would be there. It got to be a routine, and the neighborhood knew we were there.
Yes.
And they would come out, like, religiously on Saturdays.
Just to see us practice.
Just to see us practice.
That's William J. Upton. He was the youngest of the group, only 12 years old, when he learned to throw a punch and take a fall in Athens Park. The men weren't Black Panthers or any other militant group, but they were at the beginning of the fight of their lives. From KCRW, this is Welcome to LA. Episode 10, Buffalo Soldiers.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Hey everybody, it's David here. Thanks for listening to season 2 of Welcome to LA. I put these stories together before everything changed, before the pandemic. I know these are tough times, and I hope these new episodes are bringing you a little bit of joy, no matter where you are in the world. I love this city, and I want to share a way that you might be able to help the people who live here. KCRW, the home for this podcast, is partnering with the LA Regional Food Bank. The food bank serves more than 300,000 people every month in an effort to alleviate hunger for low-income families and folks who are struggling to make ends meet in a city that is very expensive to live in. If you're in a position to help, donate to KCRW at kcrw.com/donate and choose to support the LA Regional Food Bank in lieu of a thank you gift. Thank you. In 1866, just 1 year after the Civil War ended, Congress created 6 all-black cavalry and infantry units. The soldiers were sent out west to build the new America. Mostly, they laid railroad tracks, built roads and forts, and they protected white settlers and suppressed Native American resistance to westward expansion. They came to be known as the Buffalo Soldiers. It was the Native Americans who named them. Some say it was because of the black soldiers' curly hair, which resembled the buffalo's mane. Others say it was a name given out of respect, that the Native Americans regarded the soldiers as fierce warriors. Or maybe it came from the buffalo fur coats that the soldiers wore in winter. Throughout the Indian Wars, the Buffalo Soldiers made up 20% of all U.S. cavalry, and they became the first wilderness rangers in America when they were sent to protect Yosemite and Sequoia National Parks, 10 years before the creation of the National Park Service. 100 years later, in the 1960s, Alex Brown was a member of the Buffalo Soldiers a group of Black Civil War reenactors who specialized in horseback riding in Los Angeles, where they dressed up like the original Buffalo Soldiers for special occasions.
The Hollywood Parade, the Watts Parade. But as time developed, things kind of escalated a little bit.
And one day the men were invited to ride on an episode of the TV show High Chaparral, a Western starring Leif Erikson and Cameron Mitchell. And they appeared in the parade scene of the film adaptation of the musical Hello, Dolly.
We rode in Hello, Dolly on the back lot of 20th Century Studio. And at that time, our founder, Eddie Smith, was saying, well, you know, if there's a need for Black stunt people, which there were none at the time, you know. And I can remember that very vividly. He's coming up to me and saying, look, man, we need a Black Stuntman Association.
Back in the early 1960s, there was no such thing as a Black stuntman or woman in Hollywood. There were Black actors, and they needed stunt doubles just like any other actor. But the practice at the time was to do what was called a paint down. A paint down is basically blackface that covers the entire body.
And I'm sure you sitting here and everybody out in the radio audience know what the paint down is about. It was about blackening white faces to have them do stunts.
But all that changed in 1965 with the TV show I Spy. It was about two Pentagon spies posing as tennis hustlers, traveling the world, chasing women, and challenging wealthy aristocrats to tennis matches.
If you are really just this crazy fellow traveling around playing tennis, bum, 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 but I know you are more than that. You are half of one of your country's most effective intelligence teams, and I know you have been briefed about my experiments in conditioning animal behavior.
Brainwashing.
In the 1965 episode called So Long, Patrick Henry, secret agents Kelly Robinson and Alexander Scotty Scott are sent to Hong Kong to extract an American Olympic athlete who has defected to Red China. In one of the chase scenes set in Hong Kong, the camera zooms way out so you can't make out the faces of the actors as they leap across rooftops and scramble over a steep cliff in a hillside chase scene. Agent Scotty was played by Bill Cosby, and he refused to let a white stuntman play his double. He demanded a Black stuntman, Calvin Brown, to be his body double. And around this time, the Buffalo Soldier reenactors had gotten together and formed the Black Stuntmen's Association, which was really just a name. None of them had any actual experience as stuntmen. And the white stuntmen who worked in show business weren't interested in training anyone who could potentially take their job. So the Buffalo Soldiers found a park in Compton, not far from the stables where they kept their horses. And they started meeting regularly, teaching themselves to throw a punch at just the right angle so it missed but looked real on camera. They jumped off the bleachers onto old mattresses. And one of the people who came to the park and worked with them was Bill Cosby's stunt double, Calvin Brown.
He knew a little bit more because he had the support of Bill at the time, right? So Calvin came out trying to, along with others, he wasn't the only guy.
In addition to all the stunt training, they rented cars and motorcycles to practice driving stunts, doing donuts and evasive slides in empty parking lots. And slowly, they developed the skills to become stuntmen.
All we ever wanted was jobs, just to get an equal piece of the pie, a little sliver. So when we began to make inroads, the white guys was getting a little insulted because prior to that, any time they had a Black actor or actress, they would paint them down. So as we began to make little slivers inroads to the motion picture business, the other white stunt group was getting a little insulted at the fact we had begun to infringe onto their financial base. So we had a lot of opposition.
Over the years, the Black Stuntmen's Association has filed 32 lawsuits in their fight for equality in the film industry, including a 1976 case that forced the major studios to abide by federal mandates against discriminatory hiring.
We went in and kicked ass on 32 lawsuits, and we won all 32 lawsuits against the film industry. You tell me somebody else has done that to open the doors.
Yes. See, our motive was never selfish. It was in the beginning, because all we wanted was a job. But in doing so, you can't do this thing alone.
Eventually, the black stuntmen got a proper place to train, and they stopped meeting in Athens Park. More and more of them started getting work. And in 1989, many of the BSA members all worked together on the Civil War movie Glory.
You know about Glory, mm-hmm. with Matthew Broderick and Denzel Washington and Freeman.
Yeah.
Glory tells the story of the 54th Massachusetts Infantry Regiment, one of the first all-black Union Army regiments. The filming of the battle scenes took place on a beach in Georgia.
We were all there on that lousy beach with fleas and everything for 3 weeks, charging up that hill. But it was a chance for all of us
to work together,
to get to be together.
Was that the first time you'd all worked together on a movie?
Yeah. That's the first time I'd ever been with that many black people ever.
Yeah. We had every stunt guy.
What was it like?
It was fun.
If you around a bunch of stunt guys, you're going to get some lies and some stories. So they every line, and you know. So that was the fun part of it.
The not-so-fun part was charging up sandy hills wearing a bunch of heavy gear, getting eaten alive by bugs. It was grueling work, but unlike a lot of stunt work, not particularly dangerous. Stunt performers are asked to do incredibly dangerous things. Even with the precautions taken to keep stunt performers safe, it's a brutal job. Take, for example, the story of Henry Kinji versus the Oak Tree. Kinji was a co-founder of the BSA and one of the only original founders who still works steadily. He recently finished shooting a Fast and Furious movie in Tbilisi, Georgia. He also played Goody in the movie Car Wash and has a ton of credits. One time early in his career, he was working on the Dukes of Hazzard when the director asked him to perform a driving stunt.
There's a shot with Roscoe, was supposed to jump into a tree. And for a few days, Paul kept telling me, well, you know, I want this car to land up in the tree.
This is a clip from YouTube of a speech that Kinji gave recounting the incident.
I want you to land right there.
So this director points to a big oak tree that has sort of a Y shape to it. And he tells Kinji that he wants him to launch a car off of a ramp and land the car in the tree, so that it comes to rest in the crook of the branches. For 3 days, Kinji tried to wrap his mind around this impossible task. He just couldn't see how it was physically possible. And then the day came. Kinji climbed into the driver's seat. The director called action. He revved up the engine and sped towards the ramp that launched the car into the air. It smashed head-on into the trunk. The force of the collision was so great that the front end of the car was pushed 3 feet back. The engine block broke, the driver's seat slammed into the steering wheel. Kenji's ribs were separated, he damaged his pancreas and broke his neck. The director used the shot, even though the car didn't get stuck in the tree.
Directors are funny people. They just want what they want. And if you don't realize that, you shouldn't be there.
It's hard to watch the clip of the car smashing into the oak tree, knowing that there's a person inside who was injured so badly. But in his retelling of the story, Kinji is all smiles, and the audience of fellow stuntmen laugh uproariously as he ticks off the injuries he sustained. But the upside to a life of broken bones was the money. Being a stuntman paid way better than the jobs that the BSA founders had when they first tried to break into the business. Even at 12 years old, William and his family saw how lucrative it could be.
My mother and father were working. They were making like $60, $65 a piece a week back in 1967. Okay. My mother asked Eddie, how much would he be making if he does stunts? Back then in 1967, the contract was $120 a day.
Wow.
I still got it in my thing.
Yeah, I'm good.
120. And my mother said, what? $120 a day back in 1967? He said, boy, go over there and join that group.
Over the years, more and more black stuntmen and women have made gains in the industry. But one of the biggest barriers to that progress is the lack of black stunt coordinators. They're the ones who do the hiring.
Right now, we probably have a 0.5% of women who are coordinating. You know, there's one young lady who just won an Emmy, Shauna Duggins, and then we have Melissa Stubbs. Then we have Julie Michaels, and I'm myself.
LaFay Baker has been working as a stuntwoman for over 25 years. In 1998, she became the first African-American woman to stunt coordinate a big-budget project, the TV movie Introducing Dorothy Dandridge, starring Halle Berry. Not having women and people of color working as coordinators is especially problematic when it comes to hiring what are called nondescript and utility stunt roles. For example, LaFay was working on Mission Impossible 3, and there was a scene where they needed a bunch of people in the background running on a bridge.
The director, which was J.J. Abrams, noticed that there weren't any women on the bridge. So then he's like, wait a minute, we got to get some women on the bridge. I need some off ethnicities. So they brought the women in. I think we were for 2 weeks or whatever. But it was like, you just don't think about it. If you work on a show, you're thinking about bringing only your friends. If I'm a stunt coordinator, I'm thinking about bringing a diverse group of people, you know, to get the job done.
LaFay didn't grow up wanting to be a stunt woman, but she's always been athletic and driven to be the best. At 12 years old, she set a Guinness World Record.
As a teenager, when I was a hula hoop champ for WAMO. So in the process of being a hula hoop champ for WAMO, I had the opportunity to actually break the Guinness Book of World Records, 12 and 58 hula hoops at one time when I was 12. So that's one reason how I got into the business.
Baker's first taste of show business was as a performer on various talk shows, twirling dozens of hula hoops for wide-eyed audiences. But her mom pulled her out of the industry and said, you're going to college. After she graduated, she became a probation officer and didn't give any serious thought to ever pursuing a career in show business. But one day, a guy just casually suggested she become a stuntwoman. She thought that sounded crazy, but it planted a seed. And one day, she told a coworker that she was thinking about it.
But I was just talking. I did not know it was a possibility he knew someone. So what happened was, his best friend just happened to be one of the top black stunt coordinators, and they had a workout and was training people who were athletically inclined to become a stunt person.
Since then, Baker has gone on to work on dozens of projects, from breakout hits like the TV show Lost to the movie Green Lantern and countless smaller productions. Late in her career, she also joined the Black Stuntmen's Association as part of the organization's efforts to include more women. Baker loves being a stuntwoman. She loves the action and the camaraderie and the money. But her body has paid the price. One of her worst injuries happened on the set of the Fugees music video for the song Ready or Not.
Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you.
One of Baker's specialties is trick motorcycle riding. And the shoot called for a scene where she would jump a motorcycle off a ramp and fly through the air.
But there was a cliff on each side. It's a place called Latigo Canyon in Malibu. So you couldn't see anything. So I did the jump 3 times successfully.
But on the 4th take, there was a miscommunication of some kind. And no one told her that there would be a smoke machine.
Apparently, the first 3 times, the smoke was very light. Because you ride a motorcycle, you just think it's just dirt, whatever. So I guess they wanted to add more smoke, and they'd never told anybody they would, you know, have smoke. Normally, if it's something like that, they would have like a white tape so you can kind of have a guideline going on the ramp if it's going to be something of that magnitude. That didn't happen because no one told me about smoke.
She couldn't see anything, and she failed to speed up enough to make the jump from the ramp. She crashed onto the pavement and broke both the joints in her jaw and shattered her mandible in 3 places.
Blood was coming out. Every time I would talk, the more blood would come out. And they would say, LaFay, you got to stop talking. This is vain. I kept saying, no more pretty teeth. That's all I kept saying. And they was like, LaFay, you got to be quiet. Stop talking. And so every time I run my tongue across my teeth, I would scream, ah, no more Britney Jean. Ah! You know, they told me that's what I would, you know, say, right? They had a helicopter come in because this is what in the canyon, whatever. So the helicopter guy came in and he was trying to move me and whatever. I say, why are you trying to move? I can move my own self. So I just scooted my body on the little gurney, whatever. That's when they said, oh, she's going to be okay.
She was flown to the hospital where she lost some teeth, had 13 root canals, and then another 10 hours of reconstructive surgery. She spent the next 9 months recuperating.
I guess I was just like in a dream. I don't know. All I was focused on, I got to get healed. Because it's like I was just working on automatic pilot the whole time and I didn't know it. Because I just wanted to get healed. I was like, I work too hard. I love this business. I got to get back to it. I went out and bought another motorcycle. My mom was upset.
These days, LaFay doesn't go as hard as she used to. Every year, there's a new batch of younger, hungrier stunt women who are willing to fall from a little higher, hit the ground a little harder, and push the limits of their bodies. But she's still working, hoping to coordinate more so she can keep hiring diverse crews. She also started an award show for stunt women and a nonprofit to help young women of color get into the industry. And there is still an ongoing fight over paint downs. Surprisingly, the practice of darkening white skin didn't end in the 60s. As recently as 2014, SAG-AFTRA, the union that represents stunt performers, investigated a paint down that happened at Warner Brothers. The studio acknowledged the incident and said, quote, the situation has been rectified and we regret the error. Stunt performers don't have a voice on screen. They're bodies whose sole purpose is to absorb violent blows, get set on fire, fall from great heights. And for stunt performers, just like the original Buffalo Soldiers and the members of the 54th Massachusetts Infantry, their body is their voice.
That's not an honor. I got two concussions, three broken ribs, brand new $10,000 titanium knee. But if I was 40 years younger again, I would still go back and be with the BSA and do stunts. It's a wonderful industry. It's like Alice looking to the looking glass. It's the best career you could ever think of. Not because you travel, not because you get paid. It's because you meet people and you do things that you didn't think your body could do in life.
Today, the founding members of the Black Stuntmen's Association are pretty much retired. But they're still fighting for equality, mostly working behind the scenes to get some recognition for the doors they opened. Their next big goal is to raise the $50,000 they need to get a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
It never ends, you know. So the more we fight it, the better it'll be for other people. The ones that's coming behind us in this generation behind us, they got to keep going too. And I always tell them, don't let the wagon get stuck in the mud because it's too hard to push. Everybody's got to push. Everybody got to help keep this thing going. Because once you get it stuck, it's too hard getting it back up out the mud.
And even though they are retired, William and Alex keep paying their union dues just in case they get offered one more gig.
Most of us right now at this stage, we're retired. We're not working anyway.
Alex, your SAG card is still active, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, mine is still active, too. Yes.
This episode was produced by me, David Weinberg. It was edited by Sonia Geis and Nick White. Sound and mixing from Ray Guarna. And special thanks to Chrissy Barker and Phyllis Ellis.